Today is Wednesday, May 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden vows to legislate the rights to abortion into federal law amid protest over the fate of abortion rights.
This is devastating to reproductive rights, but also to the health of people who need access to abortion.
The UN and the Red Cross evacuates dozens of people from the besieged town of Mariupol.
Tuesday's evacuation is the latest success of the Safe Passage operation coordinated by the UN and ICRC, which began April 29th.
And journalists and human rights champions mark World Press Freedom Day. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Joe Biden has vowed to work to legislate the rights to abortion into federal law. This as he slammed what he calls a, quote, radical, unquote, leaked draft opinion, suggesting the Supreme Court is poised to overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade case that legalized abortion nationwide. On Tuesday, Biden warned that a, quote, whole range of rights, unquote, are in jeopardy if it holds. Earlier, the court confirmed the authenticity of the leaked draft, and Chief Justice John Roberts said he had ordered an investigation into what he called, unquote, egregious breach of trust, unquote. Crowds gathered outside the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington after the leaked initial draft majority opinion reported by Politico that the court has voted to overturn the law based on the opinion written by conservative Justice Samuel Alito. For other ramifications of a possible overturn of the law, I spoke with Sonia Sutta, a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School.
I have thought that there was a very good chance that the court would hold that Roe v. Wade should be overturned. If you listen to the oral argument last fall, it was pretty clear that Justices Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and even Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett would be okay with overturning Roe v. Wade. And the only conservative justice who seemed to not want to think about overturning Roe v. Wade and just focus on the 15-week ban was the Chief Justice. So I have felt that there were really only two possible outcomes. Either they uphold the Mississippi law and don't say outright that they're overturning Roe v. Wade, or they would deal with what this draft opinion does and overturn Roe v. Wade outright.
What would be the ramifications if they overturned Roe v. Wade?
The ramifications would be that the number of people who cannot access abortion will increase. I think it's important to note that the court has allowed a lot of restrictions of abortion already, making abortions very difficult for many people to access even now, even while Roe v. Wade is ostensibly good law. What this would do is make access even more difficult for people in the 24 or more states that will have trigger laws and ban abortions outright. People with means will still be able to obtain abortions. People without means will find it very, very difficult to travel to states that are much more supportive of reproductive rights. So it's going to be pretty devastating. It's not just what happens state by state, but Congress, if the composition of the Congress becomes Republican majority, we could see efforts to ban abortions nationally, and they wouldn't be limited by a constitutional right to abortion. Whether Congress would have the authority to regulate in this area would be a question that would lead to lots of litigation, but it would certainly embolden Congress to try to create a national ban on abortion across the country, which some conservative Congress people or just conservative people generally have suggested.
Some analysts fear a never-ending legal battle and maybe a cultural war in states effectively dividing the country into two if the report holds true. Do you share this?
I think we're already there with or without this leak. And the opinion says we've been divided. Roe didn't end our division. Casey didn't end our division. But this opinion isn't going to end our division. It's only going to inflame it, particularly the way the opinion's written. It's incredibly strident. It's disparaging of everything that lies in the Roe opinion. It just pays no attention to the notion that there might be competing views. And it gives a little bit lip service to, you know, people don't always agree. But the opinion is just so harsh that it is going to do very little to end the culture wars. It will only inflame them. But we're already there. I mean, if you think beyond abortion to questions about education in the schools and education, you know, transgender treatment, we're such a divided nation right now. So is this going to make it worse, or is this just a symptom of how far we've come in our division?
And how will this affect maternal health?
So I think it's really important to emphasize that abortion is part of healthcare. It is healthcare. And it is not treated by that in this, like that in this opinion. So I think we really should worry about people who are not going to be able to access abortion. If the states were to criminalize women's efforts to seek medication abortion, then I think we really are talking about very serious health consequences. There may be health reasons why people need to get abortions earlier. So yeah, this is devastating to reproductive rights, but also to the health of people who need access to abortion.
That's Sonia Suter, professor of law at the George Washington University Law School, speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The United Nations and International Committee of the Red Cross accompanied 127 people from the outskirts of Mariupol, Ukraine, on Tuesday to the town of Zaporizhia, about 230 kilometers northwest of the besieged city. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tuesday's evacuation is the latest success of the Safe Passage operation coordinated by the UN and ICRC, which began April 29th. That operation liberated 101 women, men, children, and elderly people who had been living in bunkers below the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol for more than 2 months, while their city was being bombed by Russian forces. Dorit Nizan is the World Health Organization incident manager for Ukraine. Speaking from a reception center in Zaporizhia, she says preparations have been made to care for the physical and psychological needs of the new arrivals. She says the hospitals are well equipped with medical supplies and equipment and are being supported by volunteers and health workers.
As you know, many people left these regions because they are close to the contact line and they were, you know, under fights and shelling, but many of the health workers stayed to deliver, to help. And those that left are replaced by other healthcare workers that came from the other areas that were occupied.
Nizan says a steady stream of people have been coming to Zaporizhia from Mariupol and the vicinity. She says some people stuck at the contact line in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, where intense fighting has been taking place, arrive in cars driven by volunteers. Nizan says she does not know the condition of the people who arrived by bus from Mariupol, but that health workers are on hand to help them.
We are ready for all what you just mentioned, burns, fractures, and wounds, as well as infections, diarrhea, respiratory infections. And we are also ready to see if there are pregnant women, children, malnutrition. We are all here and the health system is well prepared.
She says no major injuries have been found among the people who already have arrived. She adds that mental health is a big concern. Before Russia began its attack on Mariupol, around 500,000 people lived in the bustling port city. Today's population is believed to have been reduced to around 100,000. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Journalists and human rights champions are warning of threats to press freedom and democracy by the spread of disinformation, hate speech and propaganda through digital technology as media professionals marked World Press Freedom Day Tuesday. From Geneva, again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
At a special event to mark World Press Freedom Day, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet paid tribute to the courage and determination of journalists who continue to work in the face of ever-increasing harassment, intimidation, and risks to their lives. Bachelet notes last year, 55 journalists were killed. This year, she says, 6 journalists and 1 media worker have been murdered in Mexico, and another 12 journalists have been killed in Ukraine since Russia invaded that country on February 24th. She warns the rising use of surveillance tools such as the Pegasus or Kandero spyware intrudes deeply into people's devices and lives.
The use of spyware has led to arrests, intimidation, and even killings of journalists. It has endangered their sources. It has put their families at risk. To counter these risks, journalists are often forced to take the dangerous path of self-censorship.
Last year's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov, says Russia faces a broken future because of President Vladimir Putin. He says the destruction of independent media under Putin's rule and propaganda against Ukraine have been crucial in triggering the Russian invasion. Muratov speaks through an interpreter.
What sets this war apart is that it is the first war in the world which we watch in digital format. From now on and forever, forever, for the rest of the human history, when you type the words Mariupol or Bucha in a search engine, we will see a destroyed city and killed people.
Co-laureate of last year's Nobel Peace Prize, Philippine journalist Maria Ressa, agrees the suppression of facts by Putin has made it possible for him to wage war in Ukraine.
Without facts, you can't have truth. Without truth, you can't have trust. Without trust, we have no shared reality, no rule of law, no democracy. Journalists, human rights defenders, anyone under attack, anyone can be targeted. We are all defenseless in information warfare.
Ressa says propaganda plays on the fears of people and presents lies as facts. And she says people who believe lies are facts are people who can be controlled. She warns it is when facts are destroyed that democracies are destroyed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission says it is investigating a video shared online that appears to show government troops abusing and then shooting an ethnic Tigrayan boy. Jelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
The four-minute video reveals a young boy being surrounded by men in Ethiopian army uniforms. The forces are seen abusing an alleged ethnic Tigray teenager who they refer to as being from Abi Adi, a location in northern Tigray region of Ethiopia. In response to query from VOA, the State-run Human Rights Commission says it is gathering information regarding the incident. In the video, the boy with blood on his face is seen sitting while men in uniform surround him and threaten him with death. One of the men in uniform calls for the boy to suffer rather than being killed immediately. They tell another teenage girl to forcefully feed the boy. Finally, one man steps forward and fires on the boy, and the video ends. VOA cannot independently verify the location of the incident or the identities of the individuals in the footage. Asked about the video, both the Ethiopian government communication minister and the Ethiopian Minister of Defense spokesperson declined to comment. A similar incident was reported by rights groups in January 2021, in which Ethiopian army members were seen executing a number of civilians in Mahabere Dego in central Tigray. Rights groups Amnesty International had verified the killing of 11 civilians in that incident. Forces from the rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front also have been accused of committing human rights violations. In February 2022, Amnesty International reported that TPLF forces and their affiliates have killed more than a dozen people and gang-raped women in towns of the Amhara region they occupied. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission recently reported that more than 740 civilians were killed in Tigray War between July of last year and this March. Both the government and the TPLF deny accusations of rights violations, saying their operations do not target civilians. Galmudait for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, former President Donald Trump's businesses and inaugural committee have reached a deal to pay Washington, D.C. $750,000 to resolve a lawsuit that alleged the committee overpaid for events at the Trump International Hotel and enriched the former president's family in the process. That's according to the District of Columbia's Attorney General. Attorney General Carl Racine announced the settlement agreement in a tweet Tuesday in the case against the presidential inaugural committee, the Trump Organization, and the Trump International Hotel in Washington. In a statement, Trump blasted Racine and noted that the settlement includes no admission of guilt or liability. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. The religious holiday celebrated by Muslims, Eid al-Fitr, Feast of Breaking the Fast, marks the end of the month-long dawn-to-sunset fasting of Ramadan. Eid al-Fitr has a particular Islamic prayer generally performed in an open field or large hall. But it may only be performed in congregation. Muslim Americans started their first day of Eid praying in Islamic centers like Dar al-Hijra in Northern Virginia. As Imam Shekhar El-Sayed explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi.
We used to do it in a large field or exhibition or celebration hall, but for several years now, we are doing several prayers in Dar al-Hijra facility because people complained about traveling a long distance to Washington or to the Expo Center in Virginia to attend a large gathering, which we used to do with other Islamic centers cooperation, because the hall would be much larger than one Islamic center to use it. Sometimes we used a rented hall from a community college or university, but currently we do several prayers at the Dar al-Hijra facility itself. People pray inside, and every prayer takes about maybe half an hour or 40 minutes to finish so that the other group will be able to come in. And we lit the parking also. We get more police to help us with the parking and the traffic around the center. And alhamdulillah, they are cooperating and they are helpful in that regard. So we do have about 4, 5, 8 prayers in the same facility that are done every hour.
Eid festivities usually include new clothes, fun for young Muslims, toys for the kids. With the tough economic situation and inflation, how did your center help Muslim families celebrate Eid, and what kind of program for Eid did you have for kids?
We do celebrate the Eid with a very special program for kids. We do it on two fronts. Number one, we collect new toys that people buy and donate physically. And we also collect donations specifically for toys for kids. And we try to choose things that are productive, like educational toys in particular, small books for young children, books for mothers to read for their kids, things of this sort. So we make sure that the gifts we get for the kids are specifically helpful but enjoyable at the same time. So we distribute those during the Eid party, which will come May the 5th. We do the actual celebration. We bring a company that makes setup of slides and jumping toys and tambourine, things of this sort that the kids enjoy playing. Sometimes we are able to get a small farm donkey that young kids can have a ride and enjoy that. But we use the whole parking lot for toys and things that kids enjoy in a theme park or something like this.
That's Imam Shekhar El-Sayed speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shinawi. New research shows that the island state of Tasmania in Australia has become one of the first parts of the world to become not just carbon neutral, but carbon negative by reducing logging. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The researchers trace back the start of a fall in greenhouse gas emissions in Tasmania to around 2011. The study by the Australian National University and Griffith University in Queensland found the downturn was the result of a significant drop in native forest logging. It helped turn the island state that sits off the southern coast of the Australian mainland from a net emitter of carbon to a negative emitter. The researchers believe it's one of the first times on the planet that anyone has ever done this kind of carbon emission reversal. Lead author Professor Brendan Mackey is from Griffith University.
It was a dramatic turnaround. There was basically a mitigation benefit of about 22 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent per year. The state of Tasmania had become carbon negative. It's the result of a major change in forest management. For a number of reasons, there was a large and rapid drop in native forest logging. The other thing that's important to note about Tasmania, and another reason why they could be carbon negative, is that they don't use much fossil fuel, and that's because they have a lot of hydroelectricity.
The study asserts that Tasmania's change in forest management could be applied elsewhere in Australia and in other parts of the world. It states that tree farms or plantations would help to satisfy the demand for timber without increasing emissions associated with larger scale logging of native forests. Only small sections of native woodlands in Tasmania are logged each year, and industry representatives have said that sustainable practices ensure that every single tree that's harvested is replanted or regenerated for the future. The Australian University paper reports that a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions was from deforestation and degradation due to the exploitation of native forests. In the Australian state of Victoria, the government has acknowledged that native forest logging generated emissions that were the equivalent to those from 730,000 motor vehicles every year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including in a rare leak from the highest court in the U.S., the political journalism company Politico reports it has obtained a draft Supreme Court opinion showing much of the court in favor of striking down the landmark Roe versus Wade decision that legalized abortion nationwide. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinonofo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recently released annual threat assessment by the U.S. intelligence community predicts that Iran will remain a regional menace with broader malign influence activities. The report notes that U.S. personnel, partners, and interests are at risk from the Iranian regime's support for terrorist proxies and the rogue Syrian regime, as well as from Iran's growing willingness to engage in aggressive cyber attacks. In addition, Iran continues to work on its ballistic missile program and has resumed certain nuclear activities beyond the limits set by the Iran nuclear deal. The United States withdrew from the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, in 2018 under the previous administration. For the past year, the United States has been in indirect negotiations with Iran over a mutual return to full implementation of the JCPOA. As State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, every challenge that we face and would face from Iran, whether that is its support for proxies, its support for terrorist groups, its ballistic missile program, would be all the more difficult to confront if Iran were in the possession of a nuclear weapon. The first thing we want to do is put Iran's nuclear program back in a box to take that challenge off the table. There has been significant progress in the nuclear negotiations, but they have paused in recent weeks over a number of unresolved issues. At a press conference, spokesperson Price said the United States is prepared for a return to full JCPOA implementation. We are also prepared for broader diplomatic efforts to resolve issues outside of the JCPOA, he declared. If the Iranians do not want to use these talks to resolve other bilateral issues, then we are confident we can very quickly reach an understanding on the JCPOA and begin to re-implement the deal itself. It is Iran that needs to make this decision. Spokesperson Price emphasized that the United States is equally prepared for scenarios in which there is a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA and scenarios in which there is not a mutual return. We would, he said, greatly prefer the former, to have the JCPOA and the verifiable permanent limits that it would again impose on Iran's nuclear program. Whether we are able to get there or not, that is a question for Iran.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.